today. As a minister resigns over Boris Johnson's threat to break international law and following U-turns and new COVID restrictions, we look at unease on the Tory backbenches.
I've spent many hours sitting in the balcony that overlooks the main chamber in the House of Commons, watching MPs bounce up tigrishly from the green benches to deliver snatch speeches about issues they feel strongly about. But when Charles Walker stood up on Monday night to angrily lay into his own government, it was quite
something.
Charles
Walker. Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Deputy Speaker. I hope I'm not going to be too foul-tempered tonight. It's not a disposition I warm to, but...
Here was a Conservative MP for 15 years who chairs the 1922 Committee of Backbenchers, ready to deliver his argument.
Mr. Speaker, there is a worrying trend, a worrying narrative emerging, and this is a really good opportunity to get a lot of things on the record as I...
He was dressed in a smart blue suit, gripping hold of the order paper and passionately gesticulating. First on COVID.
Extremely concerned that we are placing severe restrictions on people's liberties without any recourse to Parliament.
Now, hating the idea of people being told to snitch on their neighbours.
And now today, we hear that we're going to have the public being urged to inform on their friends and neighbours because grannies followed granddad into a family home.
Calling it deeply unconservative.
This is a profoundly unconservative thing. All of these things are unconservative.
And it wasn't just that. Next came Brexit and that threat to break international law.
This House, members of this House, are constituents on the wrong side of the law.
I mean, Walker is a passionate Brexiteer.
I'm no fan of the EU. I was in every single division lobby for Brexit. I think they're a pain in the neck. But surely we have to exhaust all other options before we press the nuclear button.
But he said he simply couldn't stomach it. And then came the crescendo in which he made clear just how badly treated he and other MPs
felt. Because if you keep whacking a dog, don't be surprised when it bites you back. We are all members of Parliament and we deserve to be taken seriously. I accept there's
a pandemic. What Walker had articulated in his allowed 2 minutes, 45 seconds was a sense of frustration that is bubbling away in parts of the Conservative parliamentary party. It's a discontent among MPs that is not as obvious because the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has a huge majority of 80. But it's definitely there. And it is definitely starting to rise in volume over policy mishaps, U-turns, COVID, and increasingly Brexit.
Because I do believe, colleagues, the Conservative Party is the greatest party, the greatest political party ever. And we have to have the courage to live up to that greatness.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, why are some Conservative MPs falling out of love with Boris Johnson? Jessica Elgott, Deputy Political Editor at The Guardian. We currently have a Prime Minister with a majority of 80, so a very secure position. But that aside, there is a sense of déjà vu in the Conservative Party at the moment with rumblings on the backbenches about a number of things, including at the moment that threat by Boris Johnson to break international law over Brexit, but also over new restrictions linked to COVID. You've spent the week trying to get a sense of mood within the party. What have you heard?
So by and large, when you speak to Tory MPs, at the moment, there's a general sense of just discontent. It's not the visceral anger that you saw this time last year, but people are away from Parliament. They're at home. They're just basically reading stuff in the papers about how things are being decided.
Now, Boris Johnson's new bill to change the UK's Brexit deal with the EU will break international law, according to one cabinet minister.
And this is a moment for them to be able to send the government a message. They can't plotting corridors. They're feeling a disconnect from Westminster. And I know that that means that the whips feel that that is potentially a bit dangerous, particularly for the 2019 intake, who are kind of still a great unknown. We don't really know very much of how they think or operate. And the other thing that there seems to be amongst more long-standing Conservatives is a general dissatisfaction with the unconservativeness of Boris Johnson's government. And that's that phrase, unconservative, comes up time and time again. This law, which seems to breach an international treaty when it comes to putting in more and more so-called draconian restrictions for coronavirus. They feel like this government is U-turning constantly, and they feel like there's potentially a lot more of that to come.
Some of the stories have been almost farcical. At one point, Boris Johnson addressed MPs over Zoom to try to calm dissent. Tell me how that went.
So Boris Johnson did what was supposed to be a rallying of the troops over a Zoom call, as far as that's possible, where he said, "This is an incredibly important bill for our country. We must protect the integrity of the United Kingdom. They're trying to blockade Northern Ireland." And then just as he was in the middle of this rallying cry, he experienced, as many of us have done over the past 6 months, some internet problems where he had to drop off the Zoom call for 10 minutes. And things on the Zoom call just seemed to descend into farce. At one point, I think MPs were apparently demanding of the Justice Secretary, Robert Buckland, that he take them through the legal aspects of the bill. And according to one of them, although this is something that Buckland denies, he just refused to come off mute. And then Michael Fabricant started singing Rule Britannia to fill the time.
As you do.
One MP said they thought he probably had the lyrics up on his laptop. And apparently no one joined in.
I mean, for what it's worth, I'm glad they didn't join in on Rule Britannia, because sing songs just don't work over Zoom.
No, absolutely not. But yeah, I mean, maybe it seems that these kind of rallying calls to your MPs don't really seem to work in that way either. Not in the same way as they do in the 1922 committee rooms, grand rooms in Parliament where you can thump the desk and so on. It's a bit different doing it in your spare bedroom.
Okay, so you mentioned three areas that there are rumblings. One is COVID, another is the number of U-turns. But let's start with Brexit, because that's obviously going on right now in Parliament. This dispute, as you said, is over what happens with the Irish border when we come out of the transition period. Can you explain it?
Yeah, so it is quite a technical problem, but it is in a way crystal clear, because what the bill is proposing effectively unpicks parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol, the deal on Northern Ireland that was agreed by Boris Johnson in January.
Yes, this does break international law in a very specific and limited way.
And it breaches a treaty that isn't some kind of ancient treaty where the context it would have been unknown. It's one that was actually signed this year that Tory MPs voted for. To breach that so quickly is obviously very unpalatable for some people.
It's a great deal for this country. It delivers everything that I wanted when I campaigned for Brexit.
And the Northern Ireland deal that was signed by Boris Johnson effectively did leave some gaps. The areas where there were gaps were supposed to be agreed via a process called the Joint Committee, which involves senior ministers from the UK and from the EU. From our side, it's Michael Gove, ironing out how these procedures will work in practice when it comes to GB and Northern Ireland. And the treaty says that those will be made in joint agreement. But what this internal market bill does is it gives ministers unilateral power to decide various things about trade, whether you need to fill out export summary declarations, essentially giving ministers those unilateral powers rather than having it be agreed in the joint committee, breaches the treaty.
And clearly we've heard opposition from within the Conservative Party. Is that from the usual suspects or from new groups of MPs?
Yeah, it's very different to this time last year, because we're really not debating the principle of Brexit. The UK has left the European Union. And the people who sort of led the big rebellions last year, the former Chancellor Philip Hammond, former Education Secretary Justin Greening, Dominic Grieve, the former Attorney General, Amber Rudd, those people are no longer in Parliament. So the people now are people who are not necessarily arguing with the principle of Brexit. In fact, some of them are Brexiteers themselves. There is a thread that runs through most of them, which they are people who have spent their careers either in law or in diplomacy, and people who care a great deal about Britain's place on the international stage. So they include two former attorney generals. The big one was Geoffrey Cox, a Brexiteer, big supporter of Boris Johnson. He, I think, was the most crucial intervention. Jeremy Wright.
This bill will give ministers overt authority to break international law.
There are two former Northern Ireland secretaries, Julian Smith and Karen Bradley, and a number of other lawyers. But there are other sort of big names who maybe potentially bear a grudge against the Prime Minister. I'd say the former Chancellor Sajid Javid is one of them, although he said, you know, he'd read it all very closely and he had decided that it wasn't necessary to break international law.
And of course, we've got the five living former prime ministers all raising concerns about this. Is that something that Johnson cares about?
I mean, it's very hard to know what Boris Johnson cares about, but it is extraordinary to see all five. I suppose you might expect it from two Labour prime ministers, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, but there was also Sir John Major. And then we had this quite surprising scene of David Cameron.
The very, very last thing you should contemplate. It should be an absolute final resort. So I do have misgivings about what's being proposed.
And there's also the former Prime Minister Theresa May. She was a name on the abstention list, although she was at a convenient conference in South Korea.
In South Korea, that's a long way to go to avoid the vote.
Exactly, yeah, quite far. But we know that she's concerned because she said so in the Commons to Brandon Lewis when he made the admission that it would breach international law. She also raised the effect on Britain's standing in the world.
The United Kingdom government signed the withdrawal agreement with the Northern Ireland Protocol. This Parliament voted that withdrawal agreement into UK legislation. The government is now changing the operation of that agreement. Given that, how can the government reassure future international partners that the UK can be trusted to abide by the legal obligations of the agreements it signs?
When it came to Monday's debate, Boris Johnson himself led it, so he obviously wanted to make his stamp over this. What is his argument?
So Boris Johnson's argument is that if there is no deal reached at the end of this transition period, then there could be fairly extreme restrictions on trade between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And he said that there was a manifesto promise that there would be unfettered access between GB and Northern Ireland.
Mr. Speaker, we cannot have a situation where the very boundaries of our country could be dictated by a foreign power or international organisation. No British Prime Minister, no government, no parliament could ever accept such an imposition.
So unless we put these insurance measures in this bill, which will only be used if no other deal can be reached, it could really threaten the integrity of the United Kingdom.
That may have been a manifesto promise, but since then he signed a treaty with the European Union that did open the door to a situation in which there might be checks on goods headed from Great Britain into Northern Ireland, because they might end up in the EU. Now, at the time, Boris Johnson famously suggested at a drinks party in Northern Ireland that he didn't think that was a potential consequence of the deal. But when he made those comments, all the reporting reminded him that it was what might happen. So how can he claim not to know that now?
It's an extraordinary moment, isn't it? Because that video showed him promising they wouldn't have to fill in these export declarations, and that if anyone asked them to, they should just ring up the Prime Minister and tell him to throw it in the bin.
You will absolutely not have. And if somebody asked you to do that, tell them to ring up the Prime Minister and I will direct them to throw that form in the bin.
There was a sort of an assumption there that Boris Johnson just hadn't understood the consequences of his own treaty. And I personally don't buy that. But it was signed by intelligent people. David Frost, the chief negotiator, is an intelligent person. Michael Gove knew the detail of this bill, even if you can say that Boris Johnson isn't a details man. The consequences of it were well known. And I think that it comes back to trying to work out how long ago were the British government considering that they may just need to renege on this treaty? There are senior Brexiteers, people like Steve Baker and Bernard Jenkin, who have said that that is what they were promised before they voted for this deal, that if the joint committee process couldn't work out a way of giving this unfettered access, then they would just simply renege on that deal.
It is pretty extraordinary that we are now in a position where the government is threatening to break international law and the EU is threatening to retaliate. Now, clearly a lot of people in the Conservative Party are unhappy. But on Monday, Boris Johnson won a big majority of 77.
The ayes to the right, 340. The noes to the left, 263.
Now, that was just second reading, so it simply moves the bill onto the next stage, where it will be heavily scrutinised. And look, two Tory MPs voted against it, 30 abstained. The size of the majority is in part because the Democratic Unionist Party voted with Johnson. But does it show that on this issue, really, he's pretty safe? Or is there more to come?
So Boris Johnson has actually seen off this particular challenge to the UK internal markets bill by effectively conceding, so it appears, because the deal's literally only just been done as I talk to you. He's basically conceded that he does need to give MPs an extra vote in Parliament on whether to invoke these very, very controversial powers that are in the bill, and that will satisfy the vast majority of Conservatives. There are some, and I did speak to one ex-cabinet minister who said he could be prepared to go even further because he was so concerned about the prospect of breaching international law. And this compromise that Boris Johnson has done with Rebels Bob Neill and also with Damien Green, who chairs the kind of One Nation caucus, it doesn't actually stop the breach of international law. And all it does really is buy him time with some party management. It doesn't really solve any of his problems with Brussels. And so therefore, even though we probably now aren't going to see any kind of big parliamentary showdown over this bill, we may see further problems with Brexit come down the line, because all this really does is kick the problem into the long grass.
So look, Brexit isn't adding up to a crisis for Johnson at the moment within his party, but clearly there have been rumblings. And it isn't the only issue that is bothering backbenchers. Tell me what you're hearing from MPs around the government's response to COVID.
First of all, there's generally a bitter dismay about the handling of coronavirus in the beginning to protecting residents of care homes. You've also got the sight of Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Question Time.
And if they can't get tests, the Prime Minister needs to take responsibility. And not just about the future or something else, but address this problem.
It's extremely forensic. And that's certainly a worry for Conservative MPs, especially as Boris Johnson doesn't have in Parliament in this environment a kind of wall of Tory support behind him. He looks quite exposed.
I'm sure you would like to withdraw.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very happy to say that I think that I listened to the protestations of the Right Honourable Gentleman. I think they would have been more in order throughout the long years in which he supported a leader of the Labour Party.
One of the things that really kicked off a lot of Tory anger was the controversy over Dominic Cummings and his trip to Durham, and many of them saw absolutely heaving mailbags from their furious constituents about that, and so many of them called for him to go and he did not go, which left some of them feeling that they had no power at all to influence what was going on in Downing Street. But I think perhaps the more fierce reaction is from those who now believe that the government should not be as draconian. The sense is amongst the majority of Tory MPs that even though the handling of the crisis has not been as good as they might have hoped, they are willing and they feel that their voters are willing to give the Prime Minister and the government the benefit of the doubt. And quite a few Tory MPs have said that to me. They're worried now about the intrinsically unconservative nature of some of the restrictions on everyday life. And as an example, Priti Patel was on the radio this week saying the rule of six, meaning that you can't associate with more than six people, means that you can't even chat to your neighbours in the street if you come along them.
So just to be clear, if a family of four is out on their way to a park and they see another family of four that they know and they stop to have a chat with them, is that mingling?
Well, it is mingling. I think it is absolutely mingling. But providing, I think we have to put this into the context.
You should walk past, you shouldn't stop for a chat with another family you know in the street.
But you've got to put this in the context of coronavirus and, you know, so keeping distance, wearing masks.
You can have a chat at a distance, but I think you're saying even that is not possible.
Well, I've already said the rule of six is about making sure that, you know, people are being conscientious and not putting other people's health at risk. And
some people are really furious at that state of affairs.
But there's also a kind of libertarian wing to the party, isn't there, which simply disagrees with these restrictive measures, full stop.
Yeah, there are. But it's definitely not just the right of the party. One of the people raising concerns about the rule of six was Tom Tugendhat, very much seen as a kind of centre-right Tory chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, quite a cerebral character. Hugh Merriman, another Select Committee chair, transport this time. But he was getting extremely angry about the prospect of school children wearing masks. There are certain things that it feels like are an edge for particular Tory MPs, and it can vary what that is.
The Secretary of State is aware that I had concerns about the issue of face masks being utilised. If that means we get the schools open, then so be it. Can we please keep that evidence under review? Because it would be ideal that young children had the message that their school is safe and there's no encumbrance on their education.
Coming up, more rumblings on the backbenches as MPs count 11 U-turns in 3 months. You mentioned face masks, and that really irritated Tory MPs because at one moment the government was suggesting that the evidence was not strong in favour of children wearing them. And then they said that some schools in parts of England would need to see children wearing face masks.
And whether or not they are going to be worn in secondary schools in England, has the government committed a U-turn?
And that kind of brings me to the next section that has irritated some Tory MPs, which is around U-turns. In fact, I've seen articles totting up 11 U-turns by the Prime Minister in recent months, from whether shielding MPs will have to turn up to Parliament to vote.
And it's vital that they should, and the change we're making today is that they should be able to vote by proxy.
To free school meals.
Downing Street has just confirmed that it will offer funding for those peoples who have free school meals.
To the NHS visa charge. Extending the eviction ban.
Today, evictions are effectively banned in England and Wales for another 4 weeks, and the notice period extended by 6 months.
The chaotic response to the A-level scandal this summer.
In a huge policy reversal affecting hundreds of thousands of pupils, England, Wales and Northern Ireland have all announced that A-level and GCSE results will now be based on teacher assessments rather than grades generated.
And I could go on. How do Conservative MPs see all of that?
I think that the sequence of U-turns over the summer was just very, very irritating. Every time there was a U-turn, effectively you would see Scotland make a change. That happened on face coverings in shops. And then you would see a minister go on one of the Sunday shows saying, no, we're not considering this. Then on Monday, the Prime Minister would kind of vaguely suggest maybe they were considering it. And by that evening, everything had changed. And all the MPs who'd been out trying to defend what they thought was the government's position suddenly find themselves looking like idiots. And that became particularly irritating over the A-levels crisis. And that, of everything that's happened, I think, over the summer, was the most infuriating episode for Tory MPs, because they could see how, again, it was intrinsically unfair.
But the algorithm downgraded it to ABB. It meant she lost her place at Cambridge University.
So I come from a really, really underperforming state school background, working class family, minority as well. So by so many different sort of metrics, it was so, like, there were so many barriers against me succeeding, I guess.
You know, they're the kind of people, exactly the kind of people that Conservatives should be trying to help. And they were exactly the kind of people who were targeted by this algorithm, which Boris Johnson later described as a mutant, as if the government had had nothing to do with it. Tories were privately discussing how they thought Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary, should go over that. And again, he didn't go. And the consequences were that it was civil servants who were forced to resign. And I think that if anything, was the real eye of the storm when it came to the U-turns.
Given what you've told us about the way in which at least some Tory MPs perceive how Boris Johnson has handled these Brexit negotiations, COVID-19 and the numerous U-turns that the government has been forced to make, is it a surprise that we haven't seen more of a rebellion? Is there a sense that, given how unprecedented this period is, they're actually cutting him some slack?
I think that MPs generally have cut the government quite a lot of slack, actually. It is an unprecedented time. Remember the first debate there was over wearing masks in shops? You might have expected more Tory MPs to be critical. So although there's this general background sense of discontent, publicly at least, there's quite a lot still prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt. And I think there's a really other important reason why Boris Johnson has had quite a lot of benefit of the doubt from some MPs is because he was so ill with coronavirus.
Some positive news. The Prime Minister has been moved from the intensive care unit where he has spent the last three nights at St Thomas's Hospital.
There were stages at which people were genuinely very, very, very worried about the Prime Minister. And I think because he suffered himself and suffered so badly, there is a desire to give him some space.
But how long will that slack last? We're in a situation now where the economy has taken a huge hit. And along with everything else, we've potentially got some pretty difficult decisions around tax rises, for example, coming down the track. What does Boris Johnson now need to do to keep his MPs on side?
The key thing that will be the test of how Boris Johnson's seen over this parliament and the test of whether he retains the support of MPs is delivering on this levelling up agenda, which so many of them have bought into, particularly the new intake of MPs.
What is new government going to do? What is he going to do with his extraordinary majority? I will tell you, that is what we are going to do. We are going to unite and level up. Unite and level up.
Essentially, what most Tory MPs want to see over the course of the next parliament is the delivering of this levelling up agenda. That's so important to so many of them. And that's what the Prime Minister wants to refocus his attention on as well. But the problem with levelling up during a pandemic is obvious. But also you can't really define levelling up. It's not something you achieve in an election cycle. The real test is going to be the economic fallout for this crisis and how he and the Chancellor deal with that. So this is really only the beginning.
Jessica Elgott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was The Guardian's deputy political editor, Jessica Elgott. You can follow all her reporting every day at theguardian.com. Also, read the pieces from the rest of our Westminster team and do keep up with the Politics Live blog run by Andrew Sparrow. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.